Vasco hit a porcupine.
I don't see that fight
between the fish and the porcupine.
Welcome, members, and we'll call the meeting of Environment and Natural Resources Policy to order on January 15th, 2013. Okay, today we're going to hold off on the introductions for a little bit because I think there will be more members here rather than to break up a presentation in the middle of it. So we're going to start. We have each of you know that before us is a Bar Engineering report on deterrence and safety evaluations for the Mississippi River and specifically Lock and Dam 1. And so we have Mr. Hirsch here from the DNR and also Mr. Meyer. Do you want to come forward? And for those of you who are new that are here, Mr. Hirsch is the director of the Division of Waters and Mr. Meyer's legislative liaison to the legislature, and maybe you give us your official title. I always call you commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, my name is Bob Meyer, Director of Policy and Government Relations for the Department of Natural Resources. And with me today is Steve Hirsch, our Director of Ecological and Water Resources Division. Thank you for this opportunity to present this work that we have today. I'll let Steve talk about the history of it and how we got to where we are, but we are really at a nexus right now. We've received an appropriation, we did some research, we contracted with Bar Engineering to look at the alternatives and to evaluate where we are, to enter us into discussions with the Corps of Engineers, what they may or may not allow to be permitted, and that's really where we're at today. I view it as a fork in the road, so to speak, and it's not just the DNR that's here today, this is really a decision the state of Minnesota needs to make. In conjunction, it's not the DNR recommending to go one way or the other, though we do have a recommendation at this point. It's a decision we need to make as a executive branch, legislative branch, also citizens within the state of Minnesota. What is the investment we should be making, and what direction should we be going to protect our waters in the state of Minnesota from the threat of Asian carp? So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'm going to turn this over to Steve Hirsch, but I just wanted to make sure people realize, though we do say at the end of this, we recommend moving forward. We're doing so openly and honestly and asking you to help provide us guidance and direction because we are not going to be making this decision alone. It's with your support, with the governor's support, with your constituents who are the citizens of the state of Minnesota that we need to make this decision together and for the protection of our state into the future. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hirsch, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Steve Hirsch, DNR Ecological and Water Resources Director. And I'll just start with a very brief history just to make sure everybody is up to speed on what the issue is and where we're at on the Mississippi River. Asian carp are migrating up the Mississippi River, and they have been doing so for some years. Based on catches by recently reported catches by Iowa commercial fishing operators, it looks like the leading edge of the migration front is Pool 16, which is south central Iowa, and it's between Keokuk, Iowa, and Rock Island, Illinois. In Pool 16, commercial fishing operators reported catching about 2,000 pounds of bighead and silver carp in 2011, and this was a fair increase over 2008. And then if you go down to the pool just above Keokuk, the pool right above stream from the Keokuk Dam, it's like 10,000 pounds that they reported catching in 2011. So they are making their way here. In Minnesota, we've seen periodic captures of Asian carp for the last 7 or 8 years, usually one or two at a time. And there's no evidence yet that we've got natural reproduction or any kind of established population, but nobody knows how long we really have. We consider it an urgent situation, and we're assuming that we don't have the luxury of time in dealing with this issue. Lock and Dam number 1 was identified as a strategic location to stop or to limit or slow the spread of Asian carp a couple of years ago as part of a planning process we did with a number of other agencies and non-government organizations. And what makes Lock and Dam 1 unique on the Mississippi River system is there's really only three dams, including Lock and Dam 1, that are like it. Most of the locks and dams on the Mississippi River system, the dam part, if you will, has tainter gates that open depending on what the flow is. So the dam itself on most of the locks and dams is not a fish barrier. There's only three locks and dams on the entire Mississippi River system where this is not the case, and one is the aforementioned dam in Keokuk, Iowa. And as I just mentioned a minute ago, the Big Head and Silver Carp were already above that. And then the other two are locks and dams that are in Minnesota. It's Lock and Dam 1, which is also known as the Ford Dam, and then the lock at Upper St. Anthony Falls. So those are the only three locks in the system where you can actually block fish if you block the lock. All the other locks and dams, they can get through the tainer gates in the dam. So that's an important point to remember when we're talking about where we can try to limit or slow the spread of these fish. I think most of you know, but just to make sure, the Army Corps of Engineers has jurisdiction over the lock and dam system. And so the installation of any barrier at a lock requires approval from the Corps. And then the Coast Guard also gets involved in that approval process because they regulate particularly recreational navigation on the river. So we, as Mr. Meyer mentioned, we contracted with BAR last year to evaluate what the best technology alternatives would be for a deterrent barrier at Lock and Dam 1. And what I would do, just with the rest of the presentation, I'll try to keep it brief, is give you a summary of the report findings and then talk a little bit about the cost and then just make some final conclusions and talk about what our recommendations are. So the summary of the report findings and starting on that, electricity is one of the most effective technologies for a deterrent barrier, but it's been determined it's not a feasible option for Lock and Dam 1 due to public safety and lock infrastructure concerns. The combination of acoustics, which or sound, and then air bubbles and light technology may not be as effective as electricity, but it does not have the public safety or lock infrastructure concerns that an electric deterrent barrier would have. Neither of these types of barriers, neither the electric barrier or the sound bubble light barrier, has been tested in conditions that are similar to or applicable to a lock situation. So there's really no way to scientifically estimate what the percent effectiveness might be of any of these technologies at the lock. So placement of any sort of deterrent barrier in a lock system would have to be considered experimental from a scientific standpoint. One advantage of using a deterrent barrier in a locked situation is that you don't have to block fish across the entire length or the entire width, I should say, of the river. You only need to deflect fish away from that lock chamber into the main river channel, which in the case of Lock and Dam 1, then they would be blocked by the dam. So that's one advantage to using a deterrent type barrier in a situation like that. The other thing to keep in mind about using a deterrent barrier at Lock and Dam 1 is that it would be in conjunction with the Coon Rapids Dam, which is a physical fish barrier, and it's not a perfect fish barrier. There are times during certain water levels where fish may be able to get by there, but it is a physical barrier, and we actually have a bonding appropriation, and we're currently improving the Coon Rapids Dam with that bonding appropriation that will improve its structural integrity but also make it a better fish barrier. So That's an important point, that this deterrent barrier at Lock and Dam would be in conjunction with the physical barrier at the Coon Rapids Dam. So the BAR report concludes that since no deterrent barrier technology is 100%, including electricity, the public safety and lock infrastructure concerns associated with electricity do not justify the potential difference in effectiveness between that technology and a sound bubble light technology. The sound bubble light technology would not require any changes in existing uses of the lock. Both the commercial navigation and recreational navigation would continue to be able to go through there. But more importantly, it's highly unlikely that the Corps or the Coast Guard would approve installation of an electric barrier at the lock. So whatever proposal we decide to go forward with, if we indeed do decide to go forward, we have to go through this approval process with the Corps. And if we did that, we are quite certain that if we went with an electric barrier, we would spend about eight, nine months, including the design and the approval process, and probably close to $1 million, and we would get a no answer if we went forward with electricity. So it's important to remember that, you know, regardless of what people's feelings might be about the effectiveness of electricity versus sound bubble and light, it's very unlikely that the Corps is going to approve that technology at the lock or the Coast Guard. So talking about cost and funding just a little bit, the BAR report estimates the cost of the sound bubble barrier at Sound Bubble Light Barrier at $12 million. But due to uncertainties in the final design and construction, they give a range that could be as high as $19 million. And then annual operating costs could be as high as $250,000 a year, $250,000 a year. The current Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriation that we got last session is $7.5 million, and we've allocated about $5.6 million of that for a lock and dam, for the Lock and Dam 1 project. That, and assuming we would need about $1 million for design, that leaves about $4.6 million for construction. And our desired schedule right now is to begin construction of this, to actually finish the design and the approval process with the Corps so that we can begin construction when the shipping season closes in mid to late November of this year. And so in order to stay on schedule, we need an additional $8 to $15 million to complete this project based on the cost estimates in the BAR report. And if we want to make sure that we stay on schedule, we would need that $15 million before the session ended in order to prevent any delays. So that's the estimate on cost and funding. And just to make a few final points, and then I'll answer any questions. We do believe that Asian carp pose an urgent threat on Mississippi River. You know, nobody can be sure when these things will actually get here and start trying to establish a population, but the experience in the southern states is that it happens very, very quickly. The pool I mentioned above the Keokuk Dam, where I think they got about 10,000 pounds of bighead and silver carp in 2011. In 2008, they were only getting hundreds of pounds. So that's how fast it increased in that pool above the Keokuk Dam. So again, we can't assume that we have the luxury of time on this issue. We're well aware that an acoustic bubble light deterrent barrier is not going to be 100% effective in preventing passage through the lock, and we're well aware that it would have to be considered experimental because it's never been tested in an environment similar to the lock. We do have to remember, though, that this barrier would be in conjunction with the Coon Rapids Dam, and so potentially, we think it's really our best option right now with what's available to limit and slow the spread of Asian carp into the Upper Mississippi River watershed. And we feel it's preferable to move forward with this option rather than to rely solely on the Coon Rapids Dam. If the fish get by the Coon Rapids Dam, they have pretty free access to Mille Lacs Lake. That would be the first lake that they would be able to get to fairly quickly. There's really no good fish barriers between the mouth of the Rum River, which goes in the Mississippi River just upstream of the Coon Rapids Dam, and Mille Lacs Lake. So that would be the first major lake in Minnesota that would be threatened. We feel it's not a perfect solution, but it's the best alternative we have at this point. I think that the findings and conclusions of the BAR report do confirm what we've been saying for a while, is that the best long-term solution to keep Asian carp out of the Upper Mississippi River watershed is to close the lock at Upper St. Anthony Falls. But closing that lock would require an act of Congress. It's not something that the DNR or the state legislature, for that matter, can orchestrate. So that concludes the comments, and then I'd certainly try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hirsch, and Representative Bugnia.
Thank you, Mr. Hirsch. One of the things I think would be helpful for us to have is some context here. We have talked about how damaging it would be to get carp up north, but we don't have a financial range of what that might look like, and it would really be helpful to have that number, because when we talk about what it might cost to do some prevention, it seems like a big number to some, but so some context would be extremely helpful here. That's one thing, and then I'd have a follow-up if I could.
Yep. Go ahead, Mr. Hirsch.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I agree. I think, as you know, the Met Council actually contracted and had a report done on what the economic impacts would be to the businesses that would be affected by the lock closure, and I should have brought that with. I want to say it was in the range of about $22 million. But you can't quantify the economic impact of Asian carp getting into the Upper Mississippi River watershed and beyond like you can the economic impact to the businesses, because We don't know how far they'll spread. Once they get there, we don't know exactly what the impact will be. But you could certainly take a look at, and we do have some figures which I can get to you on what some of the economic value is of some of the water-based recreation and some of the watersheds immediately upstream. And clearly, when you look at that, the economic value of what we potentially could lose is quite a bit greater than the economic value of the cost to the businesses.
Representative Green, yes?
Oh, thank you. I think those numbers would be helpful for us. I mean, a range always works. We need to know those numbers. The second thing is, just as we're all concerned about carp getting up through the Mississippi, carp can get up through the Minnesota and get up into the Mississippi watershed. And it seems to me that we can't just move on one front. We have to think about the Minnesota River and about the St. Croix River, for example. Can you tell us where you are?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, again, good points. And the Minnesota River and the St. Croix River are much tougher nuts to crack. Not that the Mississippi River is an easy nut to crack by any means, but as I mentioned before, because of the lock and dam system below, you know, if the Hastings lock and dam was configured like lock and dam one, then this proposal would be for the Hastings lock and dam. But the fact is that the Hastings dam has those tainer gates that I spoke of earlier. So just blocking the lock there is not going to stop the fish. And the Hastings dam is the one just below the confluence with the Minnesota River. And the Minnesota River itself is a large floodplain river. When it gets high, it really spreads out, and it's in its adjacent floodplain, carries a lot of debris. It's a very difficult river to think about trying to block fish in. But we are working on a request for proposal to take a look at what our options might be for the Minnesota River and the St. Croix River. Based on what we know right now, the best option for the Minnesota River may be the flood control structure at Mankato, because there's vertical concrete walls there, so it's a place where the river's actually confined somewhat. But again, we haven't taken a real hard look at the hydrology there and what a 100-year flood looks like and what it would actually take to do that. So we want to, similar to what we did for Lock and Dam 1, we want to hire a consultant to take a look at that and take a hard look at that and see what the feasibility and the best alternatives for that might be. And then if there's any other alternatives that we may have overlooked farther downstream as well. And then for the St. Croix River, similarly, we want to take a look at the mouth there. Again, I think with the bar report, I think we'll be more efficient in the second look, because I think the bar report has helped us to eliminate some things we might have considered. Certainly at the mouth of the St. Croix, for those who don't know, there is just tons of recreational traffic there. I don't think putting an electric barrier there would be at all feasible. So it is a deflection type situation, so a sound bubble light barrier may have potential, but it's very big. It's very big there. It's deep, it's wide, and it would be extremely expensive, and I personally have a lot of doubts about what the effectiveness of that barrier, a barrier like that, might be there. But we want to take a look at both those and see if there's anything that we can do there. I don't like to be pessimistic, but in this case, I have to tell you that in these two cases, I am. I think it's going to be very difficult to stop fish from going up these two rivers. But I do agree we need to take a look at it.
Why don't Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hirsch, I wanted to kind of follow up on some policy measures rather than the financial, if I could. So a few years ago, we required that there be reporting when there was ever a catch of the three species, maybe the four species. So we've had catches I see on the web whenever there's a grass carp caught or a big head carp. So when those fish are caught, are they reported and are they delivered to the DNR, or are they disposed of?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, with bighead and silver carp, they are, you know, I mean, we only know about the ones that are reported, but they are delivered. We've been actually taking the otoliths out of there because there's work that can be done to determine where those fish originated from. So we're very interested in seeing where they, you know, where they may have been born and how far up they've moved. So we are doing that. With grass carp, the catches are pretty pretty common now in commercial fishing nets, so it wouldn't be they get thousands a year now, so it wouldn't be practical to have them all brought in. One other point I wanted to make, we do get a lot of reports from concerned citizens that are false reports. We still follow up on them, and that's good. You know, we don't discourage that, but there's a lot of different kinds of fish in the Mississippi River that jump, that are silvery, and people see them and they think they've seen an Asian carp. So we do get a lot of those kinds of reports. We try to follow up on them if it's practical to follow up. Oftentimes it's common carp, sometimes it's other species like moon eye, things like that.
Tim Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hirsch, so looking at policy matters, we have a regulation on the aquarium trade for native fish or non-native fish. Does the DNR believe that our laws are sufficient for regulating that to prevent introduction of the Asian carps through the aquarium trade?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, the way I would answer that is I would talk a little bit about how aquatic invasive species have spread in the state in general, and then take a look at fish versus other species. So we know with milfoil, for example, that spreads, you know, quite frequently. We usually get 10 to 12 new reports a year of lakes that have Eurasian water milfoil, the plant. Zebra mussel spread has been increasing in the last few years, but we've been pretty fortunate with spread of invasive fish. Now, granted, they're harder to spread inadvertently. You don't inadvertently pump fish into your live well generally and keep them alive, so they're more frequently spread by the aquarium trade or perhaps people that are in the private aquaculture or bait industry. But nevertheless, if you look at fish like round goby and ruff, which have been in the St. Louis River estuary for over a decade, they haven't spread to any other lakes in Minnesota the way that zebra mussels and Eurasian water milfoil have. So, you know, there may be room for improvement, but overall, I think we have really good laws on the books in Minnesota that we've been working on really since the mid-90s, and I worked on some of those laws myself when I was in fisheries, and I think we're in pretty good shape. There's probably some things that we have to look at here and there, but overall, I think we're in good shape with the laws regulating fish transport.
Representative Hansen.
And that would include the minnow trade and the bait movement from the Missouri watershed or the Dakota borders?
Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, yes, there was some, and I'm trying to remember what was actually done last session because the Fish and Wildlife Division was tracking it closer than I was, but there was some concern about the ability to bring in minnows to feed hatchery fish for private aquaculture facilities, and there was something passed last session to address that, and I can't, maybe Mr. Meyer remembers what it was. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I think that was addressed, or it's being addressed. So.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And then in some of the other states, there's been introductions. I think Illinois, there's a photo of someone in downtown Chicago that's holding an Asian carp because it was in a food market as a fresh food. In talking with some of the other states, there were vendors that were moving carp for algae control up through farm ponds. Do you feel you have enough statute relating for that, or do you have working with maybe the Ag Department or other inspectors that those potential routes are adequately addressed through policy?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, we have a law in place that would prohibit that activity because, you know, we were able to designate bighead, silver carp, other Asian carp as a prohibited invasive species, so it's illegal to possess them. Now, whether we have an adequate handle on what's coming in ethnic food markets or not, I'm not so sure about that.
Representative Baby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hirsch, you said that it was highly unlikely or very unlikely that the Army Corps or the Coast Guard would approve the electrical barriers. Can you tell us what that is based upon? I mean, your communications with them, please.
Sure. Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, we've been having weekly meetings with the Corps and the bar engineering and then some of our technical experts since we started to work on this report that just came out. And so the Corps has been along with us every step of the way. And the big thing there that they've communicated to us is the inability to find any reasonable mitigation measures to offset the public safety impacts of electricity really would make it very difficult, if not impossible, for them to approve electricity and at the lock. And we've heard this verbally from them on a number of occasions throughout this meeting, throughout these meetings, I should say. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of people have asked since reports come out, do you have it in writing? And no, we don't have it in writing. I don't think the Corps would put it in writing until they would go through their formal, what they call their formal Section 408 process, which is their approval process. But we're quite confident that they would not approve electricity at the lock. And, you know, if we wanted to test that, the only way to do it would be to, the only way to start the Section 408 process or their approval process is to submit detailed engineering plans. So we would have to pay the consultant to do the engineering for an electric barrier, submit it to the Corps, and then we would get their official word.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hirsch, just to follow up, so if you were, just say hypothetically, for future reference, how long would that 408 process take and so forth?
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, the Corps has estimated that the process would take up to 6 months.
All right. Mr. Hirsch, in your testimony, you said, first question, could you tell us, I recall you or someone at the department, I believe it was you, said that there had been DNA of these carp found above the St. Anthony Falls Dam. And can you tell us what that may or may not mean to our situation imminent, right away or in the long term, and how would you anticipate that that got up there?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I can tell you that we're not sure what it means, and the reason is we did a fair amount of this eDNA testing or environmental DNA testing, which tests for the presence of Asian carp DNA in the water, in 2011 at a number of sites. And as the chair said, we found some above St. Anthony Falls. We also actually found some above the Coon Rapids Dam, which was very surprising. We found some in other places as well. We found it in the St. Croix River up to St. Croix Falls, which is a natural fish barrier there. We also ended up getting a positive hit in Square Lake, which is very, very unlikely. We actually sent that in as a control. So then we started to wonder really if what the efficacy of the tests were and what, you know, if the protocols that the contractor we were using were somehow flawed. And so we'll never know for sure what all those positive eDNA tests that we got in 2011 mean. And they're still really working on that, even down in the Illinois and Chicago area, where they're doing a lot more of it than we are. The Corps is doing, you know, extensive research on what it really means to get a positive eDNA hit, because it could mean there's a live fish in the water, but it could also mean that, you know, a bird ate the fish and then excretion went into the water. I saw a slide from the Chicago Shipping Canal in a presentation where an Asian carp had actually jumped up onto the side of a barge, and then it was dripping fluids down off the side of the barge. And this is where they're more common. So there's any number of ways that eDNA can get into the water, and we just don't know for sure what might have caused all those positive hits that we got. But what we did do then, actually, what the University of Minnesota is doing, Dr. Sorensen, is one of the first things with the newly funded research institute, along with the United States Geological Survey, is they replicated the sites that we sampled in 2011 using some more stringent protocols that the Corps has adopted, that the Corps would buy off on, and then also with a more rigorous set of controls. For example, we took some samples from a tank with Asian carp in it, so they should certainly turn out positive. We took some samples from well water, which should certainly be negative. And so those results aren't available yet, but they should be available by early March, and that will perhaps shed some light on some of the results we got in 2011. But there's always going to be some uncertainty with what those eDNA results mean, at least right now, with what we know.
Mr. Hirsch, you also said, I believe you said, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the DNR thought that the best prevention was to close the dam at St. Anthony Falls. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Mr. Meyer, could you come up for a minute? And while he's coming up, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good luck. Director Hirsch, I'm curious. I'm just totally dumbfounded and surprised that our complete reversal away from electricity, and trying to understand. The colonel from the Coast Guard was here last year and testified in the wintertime about the ability for the Corps to react within 6 months and give answers, and it seems like we're 12 months later, and we really haven't even really pursued with them if they were going to give us the okay. I mean, I think that we're kind of lost here. So we never really got an answer from them on whether they would do it or not. It's just kind of like, well, sounds like they don't like the idea. Well, surprise. I mean, they never did like the idea. That's not a surprise to me. We should be fighting our tail off to make them do it and find out why they won't let us do it. And I'm surprised that we supposedly entered into all this engineering to do, and now the talk is, well, we would have needed to spend another $1 million to see if they were going to say yes or no. I mean, from what we have on public tape from last year was that this is doable. And your original proposal, the DNR's, was to put some bubbles on the St. Croix. And now you want to put some bubbles in on the Ford Dam. I'm just dumbfounded. This is just, we misled the state of Minnesota. We put $7.5 million into an electrical barrier from Lessard Sams with the idea that they were going to be electrical barriers. As a matter of fact, Representative Hackbart, if we'd have put in what he wanted to put in, unfortunately it got changed, and I don't even want to go there. But this is not what the way direction we were supposed to be going. And I think we've misled. I certainly feel I've been misled. This is not what we funded. This is, and I've never been aware of a complete change. It's my reaction to Representative Fabian. I looked at him and said, "And we gave him a fee increase. What the heck's going on?" I'm bewildered. I am. Like, we took this serious. We don't want Asian carp going up the river. So our answer is to put some bubbles and do a disco at the Ford Dam? Can't be serious. $20 million.
I didn't hear a question in there, but...
I'm done. I'm sorry. I just...
Other than Lawrence Welk will be alive and well in Minnesota?
Yeah, I just... I'm trying to understand. My question is, Mr. Chair, we didn't... Did we push the core hard enough to where you thought what we were saying?
Mr. Hirsch, or Mr. Meyer.
Or bring Commissioner Landwehr in here next time. I don't have any problem with that. This is, I'm dumbfounded. I just, you know, all the flack we took and all this stuff, Mr. Meyer and Director Meyer and Director Hirsch, and we never were given this, that this is what was going to happen, and this was the proposal.
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, just a couple of things. I don't disagree with some of the points you've made. I'm personally disappointed that we can't go with the electricity option either, but I will say I'm not surprised, and I think I've been fairly consistent in my communications with legislators over this issue, particularly last session, that I didn't think electricity was going to be a slam dunk with the Corps. We actually contracted with Fishbowl in 2004 to look at this, and they came to the same conclusion that Barr came to this time, that electricity posed public safety issues at a lock and would be difficult to implement there. So I think we've been consistent. We haven't started any design work yet. I do want to be clear about that. I did hear that too. This has been basically pre-design work to look at what the alternatives were, because we did want to really give electricity the best shot we can. I don't know how much more we can push the core on this, because the public safety issues are real. And if somebody falls into the water when this barrier is on, they could very well be killed. And I think that that's been pretty well established in the literature in a number of different places. So, you know, I think the Corps was very well aware that we would prefer electricity. I think they were certainly well aware that the legislators that funded this would prefer electricity. So I don't know if we could push them any harder than we did, but if we did, I don't think we'd have a different outcome.
Well, Mr. Chair,
we've got a couple of more. Did you want to follow
just
up?
Just a quick follow-up.
Representative McNamara.
And Director Hirsch, how many people have died in the Chicago Ship Canal in the electrical barriers that were put in there a few years ago?
Mr. Chairman, nobody has.
Well, that's. I think we gave pretty clear direction in this committee on both sides of the aisle on the direction we expected. And I just don't think it happened. And I understand it's different, and we knew what we were up against. But the colonel sat right over there and said that we could get you an answer in 6 months. And it's 12 months later, and we're like, well, we could find out in 6 months what they might do. Yeah.
Mr. Meyer, Director Hirsch said that you believe that the ultimate solution to the best that it can possibly perform is to close the St. Anthony Falls lock. Are you prepared, DNR prepared, to recommend that to this committee?
Mr. Chairman, members, well, that is the DNR's preferred option. That is not the executive branch's consensus agreement right now. The Department of Transportation does have concerns about the impacts that that presents to the infrastructure and the transportation network around the lock right now. We're in conversations with them on that issue. We're also in conversations with our congressional delegation. I understand that Representatives Ellison and Senator Klobuchar will be reintroducing their federal legislation that will allow for the closure upon the identification of a fish in certain locations. So we're working congressionally to do that as well. Of course, that does involve impacts of those businesses upstream. We are in conversations with City of Minneapolis, the Governor's Office, and Department of Transportation, but at this point in time, the closure, the silver bullet is closing the lock and dam is our, when I say our, the DNR's preferred alternative, but that does not represent the executive branch's position at this point in time.
Thank you for that. Now, we have more questions from Representative Purcell and Representative Hackbart, but right now what I'd like to do is for Mr. Hirsch to stay up at the podium and for Mr. Jeff Griffin to come forward, because we're starting to go away from the bar report and work into other alternatives. Now, I want to remind the committee that this is really, although Representative Wagenius and many of us are on the Finance Committee, and this will all boil down to money at some point. But right now, as we move forward on this, we need to think in terms of policy that this committee is going to recommend as it goes through the various committees, whether it be government operations or whatever other committees, ways and means of environment and finance, what we think is the best solution. And, you know, as a person that represents a part of northern Minnesota, I'm thinking in terms along the lines of what Representative McNamara said, was that how many people have been killed, maybe even injured by electric, and thinking of the risk and thinking of what I've learned from Representative Wagenius over the last 10 years, that a pound of prevention is worth a lot of cure. However you say that, I think you get the drift of what I'm talking about, that this could be mega problem. So that's the reason, before we start on questions him, I think we should hear what Mr. Griffin has to say, and then we'll move on with more questions. Representative Hackbarth, to this point.
To that point, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. I just wanted to clarify a few things. If you gave me a moment, I didn't have any questions for Mr. Hirsch, but I did want to clarify a few things that have to do with some questions that were brought up, if you don't mind, before we get to Mr. Griffin.
At this point, that's fine.
If you'd allow me, Mr. Chairman, I have a letter here sent to Commissioner Landwehr from the Coast Guard, and Commissioner Landwehr apparently sent a letter to the Coast Guard inquiring about electricity in these locks, and the Coast Guard sent him back a letter on June 21st of this year. And I want to read you just the first paragraph of this letter as far as what the Coast Guard thinks about electricity at these locks. This is in reply to your May 24, 2012 letter requesting a list of our parameters for preliminary evaluation of the proposed electric fish barrier in Lock and Dam 1. I should also say that I did hear Mr. Hirsch also say that their preferred method to deal with this would not only be for the Upper St. Anthony Falls Lock to close, but also Lock and Dam 1. Because there are many factors that will impact the safety operation of vessels in the vicinity of proposed electric barriers, I cannot offer a specific list of safety parameters. Any proposal must be evaluated holistically. Specific technology parameters may be acceptable for one configuration, but not necessarily for another. Competing variables include voltage, current, frequency, pulse rate, and distance create many design permutations with different safety tolerances. Now, that says to me, Mr. Chairman, that different types of electric barriers might be acceptable when other types of electric barriers are not. And I think this really boils down to what the DNR put out for a proposal when they were looking for somebody to do this study or summary for the DNR, and the parameters that the DNR set asking for somebody to put this proposal together. And I think there were complications with that back then. So what we ended up with was one proposal from one particular company that does something in a particular way. This particular bar engineering evaluation that we got back was based on what's available to that particular company and how they can do things. Now, there's patent issues and things like that on how you put together different kinds of fish barriers. Like in any other business, there are these issues. So we didn't find out about some other technologies that are out there. Like the Coast Guard said in this first paragraph, you know, we have to evaluate on what is out there and what you are proposing to do. Bar Engineering did have a proposal for some electric, but far different from what other companies might suggest. So we're hearing that electric barriers from Bar Engineering are unsafe and require a lot of electricity to operate. It would have to be turned on all the time, be very expensive to operate, but doesn't take into consideration, and we're not talking today about other technologies. I think with Mr. Griffin, when he comes up, we'll hear about some of those things. But before we got to him, I wanted to bring these things and put a little bit of this in perspective. So I think that's a good stepping stone to get to our next testifier.
Okay, well, thank you, Representative Hackbarth. And I think it went back again to what I said earlier. We're going to have to decide in this committee if we're going to have a tolerance to allow CARP up there. That's what our decision is going to be ultimately. Are we going to take a chance that we spend X number of dollars? Are we going to spend in 50 years or 20 years or 10 years A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and the sum of all the other letters in the alphabet to try and take care of this problem? And so really, in my mind, right now, as we sit in this committee, the cost isn't an issue. The cost will be an issue when we go to Representative Wagenius's committee. And our recommendation should be, this is what is best for the resources of Minnesota, regardless of the cost. Like a person with a disease, this is what the best treatment is for that disease. It doesn't matter how much it costs. Representative Purcell, can your question wait till after the Mr. Griffin's, or would you like to ask your question now? I'd give you that
option. Pass right now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And Representative Hackbarth, the follow-up.
And just to follow up to what you're saying, Mr. Chairman, I do think cost is a factor. And the cost is huge to the tourism business, to the state of Minnesota, and the resorts, et cetera, and the recreational industry of the state of Minnesota. It's huge. It's astronomical. I think that's what Representative Wagenius is trying to get to. It's going to be in the billions of dollars down the road. But I also think that you have to consider cost when you're talking about a bubble barrier, a light barrier, that's only going to stop 60% of the fish, and it's going to cost $12 to $19 million and $250,000 a year to operate. I don't see the people of the state of Minnesota accepting the legislature spending that kind of money on something that's going to let 40% of the fish through. So I think there are some cost factors that we do have to be smart about. So yes, we have to stop them, and if it's going to work, let's spend the money. But if it's not going to work, I'm not for spending the money. And Representative Dill, Mr. Chairman, you know how passionate I am about this issue. It's my number one issue. I've been working on this for many years, and we got to stop those Asian carp.
Well, Representative Hackbarth, and I think that we all feel the same way. I don't think there's anybody that wants one carp to get north of that St. Anthony Falls Dam. Mr. Griffin, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representatives. I'm going to go through just a few, maybe 15, 20 quick slides, and then I'll answer any questions.
Well, could you first give an introduction of yourself?
I will. I'm the CEO of G-Cubed Engineering in Chatfield, Minnesota. For 10 years, I was a hydraulic design engineer for the Minnesota DNR, designed numerous fish barriers all over the state, designed every electrical fish barrier for the DNR throughout the state of Minnesota. For 13 years, I've been on my own as the CEO of G-Cubed. We design fish barriers. We team up with Smith Root. Smith Root's a firm in Vancouver, Washington, that have the patent on electrical fish barriers. We team up with them and provide the civil engineering services all over the country and all over the world. Smith Root has put in 49 electric barriers in 25 years. During this time, there's been zero serious injury as a result of any of these barriers. Lock and Dam 1 and your committee. February of last year, I was in front of this committee and presented a proposal not only for Lock and Dam 1, but I also talked about Lock and Dam 2, St. Anthony Falls, and put an electric fish barrier down in the structure in Mankato there. February 9th, I was asked to provide some supplemental safety information to this committee. And February 21st of last year, the DNR combined comments from the Corps, Coast Guard, DNR, other agencies, and sent them to Smith Root and myself, and about an 8-page document full of questions that they asked us to address. March 28th, 29th, and 30th, we received permission from the Coast Guard and worked with their engineering team to look at Lock and Dam 1 and also work with their structural engineers to actually look at all the design drawings to see how it would work to implement an electric fish barrier into Lock and Dam 1. On March 30th, G-Cube and Smith Root formally addressed all the questions that were presented to us and proposed a sweeping electrical lock barrier designed for Lock and Dam 1. January 4th, as we all know, BAR released its report on Lock and Dam 1. Experimental. I was real surprised when I read the report that they totally wiped out the sweeping electrical lock barrier that we proposed and submitted and presented to the DNR Corps, Coast Guard, and all the groups. According to the BAR report, they took it out because it was experimental. However, when you read the report in page 10 of the report, they talk about the fact that the acoustic air bubbler strobe system constructed at Lock and Dam needs to be considered experimental also. And as you heard from the DNR today, and it was in their press release, that this is experimental also. So it really amazed me that they came up with a proposal that they consider experimental, but they didn't even study what we proposed at all because of it being experimental. As you heard Mr. Hirsch talk about, his main concerns are what's the core, how do we deal with the issues with the core brought up, stray voltage, lock and dam, infrastructure corrosion, harm to people, and arcing of cargo running through the structure. Stray voltage, two places in the report, both on page 8 and 10, they talk about the harms of stray voltage getting out. Page 8, potential harm to a person who comes into contact with a nearby physical object electrified by ground currents generated as a result of electric barrier option. On page 10, they talk about since there is a potential for stray voltage to extend beyond the location of electric fish barrier, it's difficult to state definitively that an electrical barrier will not impair the use of the lock. These stray voltage or ground currents are only present if there is inadequate insulation resulting in lack of electrical field containment. Of the 49 fish barriers put in around through the country and throughout the world, 48 of them have this contained with insulative material. There's one barrier that doesn't, and that's the Chicago barrier. Coincidentally, it so happened to be the one barrier that BAR used for the research here. And so that really amazed me that we have 48 other barriers all around the country and all over the world that insulate, and we do not have ground current problems, and they looked only at the one. It's real simple to do. We use insulative concrete to solve so that stray voltage doesn't occur. That was actually proposed at the Chicago. However, because they were unable to close down that section of the channel due to barge traffic, it was impossible to place the concrete. And so there, it's a limestone channel, and they just laid the electrodes right on the bottom. And as we all know, with fractured limestone, you have electric in water and fractured limestone, the water's going to go stray and get into maybe even 50 feet, maybe even 100 feet away. But that's a big difference from an insulative concrete system. Stray voltage. Constructing a barrier without insulative concrete, it's like building a house in Minnesota without insulation. The Chicago barrier requires 5,000 volts, and that's because of all the losses going into the ground. The barrier we proposed at Lock and Dam 1 was 150 volts. As I stated before, Chicago has fractured limestone walls for the charged water to migrate to. Here's a picture of the Chicago barrier. If you look on the far wall, you can see the limestone, natural limestone wall there, no lining. Here's a picture of a barrier that I put in Minnesota in 91. And here you can see it's concrete lined with insulative concrete. This is down in Heron Lake by Wyndham. Here's another barrier that we did in Norway this summer. You can see the insulative concrete being poured. This is a barrier that we actually put in this summer in Iowa. I believe it was partially funded from some of the appropriation that you did last year. This is in Spirit Lake, Iowa, which that watershed extends into the southwestern part of Minnesota. Once again, insulative concrete being poured there. The other item that Barr's report came up with as a concern that they thought that they would have troubles with the core was corrosion of equipment because of it. And no corrosion of infrastructures is expected as a result of grounding the electrical field. On page 8 of the report, they talked about potential infrastructure corrosion due to electrical field in the water. When we do a design, the electrodes are arranged so that all infrastructure is grounded and cathodic with respect to the electric field. In addition, the electric field will be contained within the insulative concrete lining. The other item that Barr talked about was the harm that can come to a person who comes into contact with water near electric barrier. As Representative Hackbarth talked about, the proposed pulse width and frequency will be much lower at Lock and Dam 1 than what was studied in the Navy report. Keep in mind that the system in Chicago has to be so hot because you don't have any insulation there. Like I said, picture it sizing a furnace for your house. If you have no insulation in your walls, your furnace is going to be 8 times larger than if you have insulation. And so the numbers that they've researched at only looking at this one site are based on an uninsulated deal. What we're proposing at Lock and Dam 1 is to provide enough energy to deter the fish versus stun the fish. We don't need to stun the fish, and so we can use much lower voltage than what's used in other installations. Additionally, the pulse. In Chicago and other places, we have to pulse 15 times a second. Because we're going to be just herding the fish out of there, we only need to pulse one time a second. It's what that means to a human being is if you fall in the water, you're not getting zapped near as often, and you have a chance to recuperate. The other important things with Lock and Dam 1, the electric field's only going to be on when the lockage is open. When the lockage is closed, which is the majority of the time, the electric field isn't even going to be on. Additionally, what we proposed when we met with the Corps and the Coast Guard and the DNR back in March was we'll have emergency shutoff, so should someone fall into the water, the lock master could hit a switch and immediately shut it off. And some may ask, well, if you shut it off, what's that going to do? Are the fish going to get through? The beauty of it is if you shut it off, the fish are just going to get in the lock chamber. And so then you don't open the upper lock. You herd them out with a hand electrofishing units and get them back out and start it up again. So even though you shut it off for emergency, the fish still won't get through. Another item brought forward that Barr felt that they couldn't overcome the core was vessels going through and the arcing on vessels, problems with that. Keep in mind, we're going to be at 150 volts versus 5,000 volts. The other thing to keep in mind, at Lock and Dam 1, we don't have any red flag protocol cargo. In Chicago, they're running a lot of gasoline tankers through and different things that have red flag. We do not have that occurring at Lock and Dam 1. Additionally, the sparking can be modeled and come up with detailed mitigation if there is any. There's a system that we put in Norway this summer. Keep in mind, if you look at the Barr's report, they talk about 2.3 volts per inch. That's the power required to keep the Asian carp out. This particular one is at 7.4 volts per inch. This one was designed for northern pike, Northern pike, they're real aggressive. If there's a bait fish at the other side, they push really hard. And this one's designed about three times as hot as what the bar report talked about for electric fish required to stop an Asian carp. This site, canoes go through. This site, tourist bus goes through. This site, kayaks go through. And so, very interesting. Here's a tourist boat approaching and going through the electric barrier. Here's a safety plan that they have in place. I know it's hard to see, but essentially 100 meters upstream and 100 meters downstream, they have a sign, and they allow the canoeists and kayakers the option of getting out and portaging around. They don't have to, but they allow them that option. Here's signage that they have as you enter the barrier. If you're running a canoe or kayak, they want you to go straight through it versus going sideways. The reason that is, if you're going straight through, you got your paddles on the side, they're both at the same electrical current. If you're spun sideways, you have a much more higher electric current on the upper than the lower, and that can cause a sensation to the persons in the canoe. Here's the signage in three different language at the upper and lower end of it. They also have the little barcode, so if you have a PDA, you can scan it, and it'll give you detailed information on what's happening there. Here's a canoe portage at the upper end, canoe portage at the lower end. I want to talk briefly on costs. The bar report talked about $12 million for electric barrier. The barrier that we proposed last year for Lock and Dam 1 was $3.5 million. The bar report talked about putting in this barrier where you got to run it all year long and $104,000 in electricity a year. What we proposed last year was $3,500 a year to run for electric bill. This is actually my slide from last year to this group. Construction costs, $3.5 million. Annual operating costs, $3,500. Optional maintenance agreement where you pay to Smith Root where they come out and check the equipment every year, guarantee to keep everything running, $25,000. Even with the state-of-the-art sonar option, the electric fish barrier at Lock and Dam 1 would cost under $5 million. When I talk about that sonar option, when we met with the Corps and Coast Guard, one of the things we talked about is putting some sonar sensors in there. So when you turn the sweeping field on, the operator can have it's almost like ice fishing or fishing, will have a graph that shows that all the fish are cleared out of there before the operator opens the gates. So you're assured that all the fish are out of there before the gates are open. This compares to the sound bubbler light option, which, as you know, was 12 to 19 million U.S. dollars. I just wanted to point out briefly, I don't want to get into details, but in the report they talk about electric being 60 to 99%. That is not the case. If you look at the Holman report and look at the statistics, that was where they studied electric at one setting in a lab, and it actually comes out to 87 to 100%. If you adjust the settings to where we truly have put them in the past, we have 100% barrier protection. The other thing to consider with electricity is it's more effective as the fish get larger. So the larger the fish are, the more they get. The bar report selectively underestimates the efficacy of electric barriers to prevent fish passage, while overestimating the capacity of unproven technology, which is supported by peer review literature, including the Great Lakes and Mississippi River Interbasin Study from the Corps of Engineers of 2012. Conclusion: the proposed bubbler sound and light barrier is an experiment as it has only been tested in a laboratory and in small channel and has never been used in such deep water or potential high water episodes as what they're proposing at Lock and Dam 1. Their own source in the bar report that did the testing in the channel of the sound bubbler strobe system states in this conclusion, our results provided evidence that this technology has ability to deter Asian carp and other fishes. Nevertheless, we do not recommend this technology to be used as an absolute barrier for preventing all upstream movement of Asian carp or other invasive fishes. Does it make sense to spend $12 to $19 million on an experimental system which is not designed as an absolute barrier? I personally have been involved in 8 electric barriers in Minnesota since 1990, and to date, not one has been penetrated by an invasive species. No additional money appropriation is required to implement the proven technology that I'm proposing. Thank you.
All right. So we're going to have Mr. Griffin and Mr. Hirsch stay up here, and we're going to have questions. We have to be done at 5:30. If we get done before then, that would be fine. The first person that we are going to hear a question from is Representative Purcell. And you may ask a question, I mean, about anything, and we'll just have a forum on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this may be for future reference, but Director Hirsch, you did say we were going to get some information probably in March about eDNA and a report, and I would just ask, Mr. Chair, if we could get some more information about the efficacy of the eDNA protocol, and I don't know, perhaps a white paper on that. I don't know, something about the, it just didn't sound, as an old lab director, it didn't sound like it met some quality assurance that I would want to put much money into, but I'd appreciate information on that.
All right. Understand that, Mr. Hirsch?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, questions? Rep. Tempest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm new to the committee, so my questions may be more elementary than what you'd like to hear. But I'm just wondering if either of the two testifiers could tell me, maybe others already know, whether these barriers, whether it's the lock and dam number one or the others farther upstream, are they all controlled by the Corps of Engineers? Are there any there which the state of Minnesota can determine what kind of barriers to install, or are all of them controlled by the Corps? And my reason for asking that is obvious, you know.
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the Corps' jurisdiction ends at Upper St. Anthony Falls Lock and Dam, so that's why we've been able to make so much more progress on the Coon Rapids Dam in the last couple of years. We have basically, you know, although it's Three Rivers Park District that actually owns it, we've been able to work with them, get a bonding appropriation from the legislature, and we actually did the design for that this year. We'll be putting that out for bids, I think, very shortly, and construction will start this year. So,
just to follow up. And I'm assuming that process does involve electrical barrier then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the Coon Rapids Dam would actually be a physical barrier. It's a physical barrier.
Electrical would not be involved.
And my recollection is that, Mr. Hirsch, that we appropriated money to help construct that last year to make those improvements. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, I think so. It was either that or the year before.
Yeah. Okay, question.
Mr. Chair, I did have the opportunity to be one of the chairpersons of the Coon Rapids Dam Commission, and I would urge each and every one of you to read that report. It comes to some startling conclusions about the actual cost to the state of Minnesota for the invasive species, the Asian carp, breaching the dam and getting into the Mille Lacs Lake area and the upper Mississippi. We considered everything from the obvious impact on the sport fishery, the impact on sales of boats and motors, all the way down to the local barber shop and the local grocery store, because given some time, this could be the greatest environmental disaster that's hit Minnesota maybe ever, and it has the potential to change our way of life as far as going up north and in the Minnesota culture up there. So I would urge each and every one of you to read that report. It is staggering, and I would just as an aside also say that we started out on the Coon Rapids Dam Commission with the idea that, well, we were just rebuilding a dam and there was money and the Three Rivers Park District didn't have it. And at that time I was mayor of the city of Champlin, and we were being asked to kick in some money for that, which we really didn't want to do. But we came to the conclusion after the DNR's report about Asian carp and everything else that the single most important part of this dam rebuild was to stop the Asian carp and provide a physical barrier. And in that report it also says that we need redundancy because the stakes are too high, and an electric barrier or similar would provide that redundancy. Thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, Director Hirsch, what are the redundancy opportunities above the Coon Rapids Dam?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, above the Coon Rapids Dam on the Mississippi River, there are a number of other dams right now that are fish barriers, physical fish barriers. I can't recite them all to you. I can get a list of them if you're interested. But it's up the Rum River. There are no other opportunities right now that I'm aware of. There is a dam at the mouth of the Rum River, but it's an extremely poor fish barrier because, for one thing, you have two different river systems, so you can have a situation where the Mississippi River is high and impounding water up the Rum River because the Rum River watershed didn't get precipitation, and so that raises the water level below the dam without raising the water level above the dam, so the difference in elevation becomes very, very small. So it's just an inherently bad spot for a fish barrier at the mouth of the Rum, and that's pretty much it. There's some small water level control structures in some of the lakes just downstream of Mille Lacs, but they are not good fish barriers either. So,
just a quick follow-up. And I was also, Director Hirsch, wondering about the ability to have an electrical barrier anywhere above the Coon Rapids Dam as redundancy. Is there any opportunities there, or is the river too wide and it never works?
Mr. Chairman and Representative McNamara, I'm not sure. I mean, I think we haven't really looked at that. It's certainly possible. I think it's big water, and it would be fairly expensive, but it would probably be possible.
Representative Ugo.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My neighborhood, the Anoka Dam right there in basically downtown Anoka is a relatively small dam. It's about, I would say, maybe as much as half a mile up from the confluence of the two rivers. It still is relatively narrow, and sometimes it's relatively shallow there. But there has been some talk among the Anoka people about something like that, too. So I don't know whether it'd be feasible or not, but it's a little further back. It's not right at that confluence, and it is a lower dam.
Mr. Chair, just wondering if there's any place between St. Anthony Falls and the Coon Rapids Dam where the river is contained in such a way that you'd be able to put in an electrical barrier.
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't know of any places that would be just an obvious candidate for an electric barrier. It's pretty big water, and it would be... It's probably doable. It would be costly. You'd certainly have to limit navigation through there, or have some way of protecting navigation through there. But
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to come back to the St. Anthony Dam and talk about that. We kind of just dismiss that as an impossibility because we say we have to have an act of Congress. That is one approach. The second approach would be to make that dam or the use of that lock obsolete. And that has already started to happen. And one of the ways it happened is, it's a long story, but the end of the story was that the paddle boat, that tourist paddle boat that went up and down through that lock, decided, no, we're not going to be part of the problem, and we weren't going to use the lock anymore. That was with the City of Minneapolis and the City Park Board, and there was this agreement. And then a lot of folks who said, we're recreational users, but we don't want to be part of the problem either, so we're not going to use the lock anymore. So what has happened is the service level of that lock was one, which means, you know, big service level. It's now down to two. So there's less service level. As I understand it, I'm a little bit uncomfortable because there should be an expert talking about this too. This is not my expertise. The city of Minneapolis is certainly considering closing its harbor And if it did, that's 25% of the current traffic would be gone. It leaves then two businesses. And we have not discussed the thought of either buying out those businesses, thus making the dam obsolete, or helping those businesses to move down the river to another port, thus making that lock obsolete. So if that lock is obsolete, Congress is going to spend money to keep a lock open? I don't think so. So I think that is a strategy that we have not taken seriously, that I don't think the DNR, unfortunately, has taken it seriously, but I think it is a strategy out there that we should spend at least a little bit more time talking about.
Well, Representative Wagenius, I agree with you on that, because the time use of money might be that is the absolute fix to that particular location. And I can tell you that in my legislative district, there's a dam. and when that dam was installed, there was a huge outcry, and this was a long time ago, about the recreational use and how that was going to work. And ever since then, there's been a recreational use portage with a trailer and truck that has taken around every single boat both ways, going downstream or upstream. Now, there's a cost to that. It's nominal. But for recreational purposes, that could be a part of a proposal, too. And I can tell you that portaging boats is a heck of a lot cheaper than trying to fix a carp problem up on the Rum River.
I would agree with you, Mr. Chairman.
And so, no, I mean, that's just how I feel about that at this moment. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for new members, just, you know, I think a number of us who've been here for a while, our jaws are still kind of on the floor because we've been through three CARP summits. I think the tally has been, we must be up around 22, 23 million that we have appropriated with bonding funds and first appropriation, I think, 5-6 years ago. We have to make difficult choices here. So I see the tally running up and up and up. Now, I asked the questions on policy before because that's a venue. And I think what's happened, and maybe I can be corrected on this, is we've been building in some barriers related to the Missouri River to try to protect against that. And those have been relatively low-cost barriers on tributaries. One thing that hasn't been addressed is connections to the Great Lakes. We don't want to have the St. Croix watershed or the Mississippi watershed be a venue getting things into Superior. So the frustration level, and I, Representative McNamara, I share your frustration on this because we've had multiple meetings, and we're going to have many more. We're going to have many more meetings on this to reach some type of conclusion, which probably is not going to be liked by many people. But if we have to weigh a continuing allocation year after year and changing recommendations year after year versus something that may provide certainty but is extremely difficult, I think that's where we're going to have to go. We're going to have to make some choices there. And, we're talking about public money here for continuing monitoring, continued testing. There's no responsible party. We can't go to the aquaculture people in Arkansas that let these loose 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. So the pockets that we have are the public pockets. And it's going to be some difficult choices that we have to make. Representative Wagenius brought up some. Representative Hackbarth brought up this. We've got the electrical issue here. We probably can hear more. I am concerned that I don't see the Corps of Engineers here. I don't know if they were invited. They were last year. and I'm sure that many of the interests that are in the room have ideas on this. But the first since we started appropriating money, the fish keep moving, and they're going to keep moving. And so at some point, we're going to reach a point where there's too many of them. So I think we're probably going to have to make some decisions and make the chips fall where they may here in terms of a tough decision. I'm cautious on continuing to every year go back and forth on recommendations with more and more dollars, because I think it'll change again in another year.
Representative Hansen, I think we're going to stop that. We're going to quit that, because we got to come to a conclusion and something that's solid. And the reason that I purposely didn't invite the Corps, and I took this opportunity for each of us who are frustrated with this system, and I hear that around the table from the existing members, and for the new members of this committee, to get a grasp on what a problem this has been and how it continues to be a problem. And it's such a nonpartisan issue. That's the other thing I like about the idea of having this as our very first hearing, because here we are now working together in search of a solution that isn't partisan at all, because it affects every single person in this state and every single person beyond our borders that come here, family, friends, visitors, whatever. So I suspect that as we move forward here rather quickly, that we are going to have to get the Corps in here, and that we're going to have here interest groups. And I'm not going to ask for testimony today from people in the audience. We're just confining this to this group, our committee, and the two testifiers and Mr. Meyer. But at some point, we're going to have to get down and dirty on this and get a decision, and very likely tell the DNR what they're going to do and live by it. Because I sense the frustration. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have the same frustration. Of just my second term, and I sat here and listened about what a critical issue this was over the last 2 years, and I don't see that we've made a whole lot of progress. And I think that the legislature was pretty clear in its intent. Where are we at? Mr. Griffin, I have another question. You talked about how effective the barriers are and how safe they are. You know, Ronald Reagan said to trust but verify. Can you provide some sort of verification documents for us on those things? And then I also have a question about, you said that you have other dams in the United States, particularly in Spirit Lake, Iowa. Was the Army Corps of Engineers involved in that project in some way, shape, or form? And if not, why not?
Mr. Griffin. Regarding the documents, I'll get them to the chair immediately. Regarding Spirit Lake, the Army Corps was not. That was on like a sub-watershed. And okay. So that was across a, you know, even though it was a large structure, I think it was 160 feet across the channel, it wasn't a navigable structure by barges. And so the Corps did not have jurisdiction. The Corps, however, we did work with the Corps on the Chicago Canal. And also last March, to my surprise, to be honest with you, the three-day period where the Corps agreed to allow our team to go in and meet with all their engineers and go through drawings and kind of put a think tank together, it was fabulous. They were very, very cooperative.
Ms. Fabian, follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to reemphasize the value, the importance of getting the Army Corps here so we can talk to them. Thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, is Director Hirsch, is there any chance that we could get Bar Engineering to chat with Mr. Griffin and see if at least so that we could have some confidence that the engineering firm that the state picked did look at all the options and understand? I don't know all the intricacies there of where this is breaking down, but does your consultant, or I don't know if they're here today, but do they or have they looked at, and I mean, there's pretty serious things here that have been brought forward, and I'm just wondering, are they willing to, so when we bring them forward here, at least we can find out if they've looked at all this, or are they willing to anyway, because I would imagine that we've ruffled enough feathers here that we probably should face some of those questions pretty direct.
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, we can. Actually, we've got the representative from Barr here, the project manager for the report here today right now. a lot of the issues that Mr. Griffin brought up are very technical from an engineering standpoint, but I do know, I can say a couple things. I know that Fire Engineering was in constant contact with Smith Root, who's the major manufacturer of electrical barriers, when they were doing this report. I can't address all the specific technical issues that Mr. Griffin has, but I'm sure that Barr could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand the engineering and that, and you know, and as we've said, there's patent issues and that, and Mr. Griffin is one of the people that Smith Root works with. I'm sure in other places they work with, and we need to have some confidence that we really looked at everything, and then that would help us along the way as we try and deal with this difficult issue. And thank you.
No more questions. Thank you very much to the testifiers. As I'm sure you're aware, this will not be anywhere near the last hearing on this issue, and I frankly await some kind of bill that may actually define what it is that we may do, and we may take that under consideration at that point. So that being said, we'll start with Representative Hackbarth. We're going to just quickly make introductions because we do have new people. And we'll just quickly start out with Representative Hackbarth, move around the table, and then go to Abigail in the Senate.
Representative Tom Hackbarth, I'm starting my ninth term in the Minnesota Legislature. I've been on Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee and Policy Committee as long as I've been here. And look forward to an interesting year.
Yeah, Representative John Purcell, District 5A, North Central Minnesota, the heart of hunting and fishing in Minnesota, outside of Chair's District, too, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Steve Green, District 2B, Northwest Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Mark Uglum, District 36A, Champlain and part of Coon Rapids.
Mr. Chair, Denny McNamara, I'd like you serving my sixth term and have been on this committee the whole time and look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan Fabian, District 1A, furthest northwest corner of the state of Minnesota. And we actually did make the outdoor life list for the one of the top 10 or 15 places in the nation to live in Roseau. So.
Mr. Chair, Tony Cornish, Representative Tony Cornish from Good Thunder, and I have Waseca and Watonwan in Blue Earth Counties, my District 23B.
Mr. Chair, Bob Eliff with the House Research Department. I'm responsible for issues regarding air pollution, solid waste, hazardous nuclear waste, and toxic chemicals.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Janelle Taylor. I'm also with House Research, and I handle natural resource issues and then the environment issues that Bob did not mention, which mostly include water.
Peter Strohmeyer, I'm the committee administrator.
And David Dill, Chair, and I represent Cook, Lake, St. Louis, and Coochaching County. And between myself and Representative Fabian and Representative Green, we've got the entire border, as I recall, from east to west and a lot south. So. Welcome to the committee, and you're going to have fun on this committee because there's a lot of stuff just like this coming up.
John Harrison, Committee Legislative Assistant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Fisher, House Seat 43A, which is down the cities here. That's the suburbs of Maplewood, White Bear, Birchwood, Montemedi, and Willoughby.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Joanne Ward, representing District 53A, which is South Maplewood, South Oakdale, all of Landfall, and Western Woodbury. And this is my first term.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm John Benson, representing 44B, which is Minnetonka and Plymouth. And I'm new to the committee, and I may have found a bipartisan committee. That would be terrific.
Love your optimism.
May, I said.
Gene Wiginius, representing parts of far south Minneapolis and parts of Richfield.
Mr. Chair, Representative Andrew Falk, District 17A, Swift, Chippewa, most of Renville, and a portion of Kennewick counties.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Eliff wasn't proposing solutions to the car problem. There no. Was.
Sounds like it, though.
Rick Hansen, represent Northern Dakota County.
Mr. Chair, I'm Barb Urusso. I represent District 42A, which is in the far northwestern corner of Ramsey County. And it includes Arden Hills, Mounds View, part of Shoreview, and a very small piece of Spring Lake Park.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jason Isaacson. I represent 42B, which is Shoreview, Little Canada, Vadnais Heights, and Roseville, in a little town called Gem Lake.
Abigail Johnson, GOP Research.
Okay, so we're going to be on time today. I'm getting out here, and we'll try and keep that as a theme as we move forward, even if we have to lay over things. Tomorrow we'll be hearing a bipartisan bill in this committee. Representative Hansen and Representative Torkelson are the first and second authors. Is that correct, Representative Hansen? Want to give a brief description of the bill that we're going to be hearing tomorrow and why that we're moving it forward at the rate that we are?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill is a product of the Drainage Working Group. Agricultural drainage and overall drainage has been a challenge in our state for over 100 years. And so several years ago, there was a working group, which is a broad bipartisan, everybody from the farm groups to the environmental groups to the local governments meet. They meet at Farm Bureau headquarters and go through the intricacies of drainage, which is actually kind of dry when you go through all that all that work. And so they go operate by consensus. So this is the consensus product of the drainage work group. We need to make this clean and move it through and try to get something. The folks have worked for 2 years on trying to get these law changes in that are technical in nature and not fiscally related.
Well, thank you for that, Representative Hansen. Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question that I didn't have before that I do have now about the bill, is that going to go to the Ag Policy Committee too? Or?
Chair, Representative Hackbar, right now it's been requested to go to GovOps. We're checking with Ag Policy.
Okay, thank you. And then also, members, I just have a brief announcement that Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance is having a little meet and greet over at the Kelly Inn. And their meeting right now started at 5 o'clock. It's from 5 to 7. If you'd like to stop over and visit with the folks from Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance.
And the new members, do you know what Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance is?
No.
Representative Hackbarth, why don't you explain that?
It's a group of all the different sporting communities within the state of Minnesota. It's Minnesota Deer Hunters. I'll just name a few. Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, the Trappers Association, Dark Horse Fishermen, Minnesota Deer Hunter or Duck Hunters, Pheasants Forever, all those different groups. There's many, many different groups in the state of Minnesota. They're all part of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, and there's going to be a number of those folks over at the Kelly Inn. They'd like to have you stop by and meet them, and they want to meet the legislators.
Okay. Meeting adjourned.